Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, why so few young women call themselves feminists? Oh, they might believe in the tenets of feminism, gender equity, equal pay, equal political representation, but identifying as a feminist seems like a bridge too far. When University of Chicago Professor Kathy Cohen asked millennial-age women whether they'd call themselves feminists, the numbers who said yes were shockingly low. So what gives, especially in a time where women are active on female empowerment? I think this is where I really need to hear from lots of you young women in our audience and maybe some more experienced feminists as well. If you're a young woman between, let's say, 18 and 35, tell me what feminism means to you and whether you identify with it or not. If you do not, I want to hear about why. If you do, I'd like to hear about why. And for the rest of us, do you think feminist movements have improved life for women? I mean, we're having this conversation in the midst of a very interesting time in politics and in the Me Too movement. So I'd love it if you gave some thought to whether the feminist movement overall, the different generations of the movement, have improved life overall for women. And then if you're a young woman between 18 and 35, tell me what feminism means to you and whether you identify with it or not. Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter, at CarrieNPR. Our guest, Kathy Cohen, is a professor at the University of Chicago. She's founder of the Gen Forward Survey, and that's the survey we're talking about this hour. Kathy, welcome. Really good to have you on the show.
Thanks so much for inviting me.
Luli Mola is with us. She's Vice President of Community Impact at Women's Foundation of Minnesota. She's in the studio with me. Luli, welcome. Really good to have you here.
Thanks so much, Carrie. Happy to be here.
I'm going to take a call right away here because I think this is some valuable perspective to get us started on the conversation to Elise in Savage. Hi, Elise. Thanks so much for calling so quickly. I really appreciate it.
Hi there. Yeah.
So talk to me about how you think about feminism.
Well, I'm 27. I'm a white woman. Mm-hmm. And I recently spent this past year in London. I do consider myself a feminist and extremely support the movement. However, there's a book circulating this past year called Why I Stopped Talking to White Women or White People About Race.
I've heard about it.
And
yeah.
It's a fantastic book. I just read it. And it's extremely critical of the history of feminism and the exclusion of black women within the movement in the UK and the US. It made me more passionate about the feminist movement and where it is now, but it made me more critical about its history.
Luli, Elise, thank you so much for calling. Luli, does that make sense to you?
Absolutely. You know, growing up, I witnessed the strength and resilience of women like my mother, women like my grandmother. And then when I discovered the word feminism, I was so excited because finally there was a word that could describe this fire inside of me. But as I learned more about mainstream feminism, I realized that it did not always include women like me or women that looked like me, particularly women of color. And so I evolved from identifying as a feminist to identifying as a black feminist and understanding that we can't define feminism through a single issue struggle because we do not live single issue lives, as Audre Lorde told us. So it's complicated. I identify as a feminist and I have my own nuance and critique of what it means for women of color and Native women particularly.
Kathy, I feel like exactly what Luli just described pops up all over your survey. Yes? What can you say about that?
Absolutely, it's all over the survey. I mean, when we ask young women, and when we ask actually young people, millennials, do you identify as a feminist? A very basic question, but, you know, not as complicated as we might like, you know, with the differences between, for example, black feminism. we see that, you know, below 20% say they identify as a feminist.
Wow.
Now, when we ask a different question, which is, do you agree with the idea that I don't identify as a traditional feminist, but I support women's rights and equality, right? Majorities of young people across race and ethnicity say yes to that question. So I think one of the things I would always remind people is that if we think about a kind of traditional or mainstream or even second wave feminist agenda of equal pay, of paying for contraception, of choice, that has become mainstream, and overwhelming numbers of young people agree with those policy positions. What's the kind of turn here is that when you then ask about the ideology of feminism, the label of feminism, that's what they reject. So they are accepting a kind of liberal political agenda that we might ascribe to feminism, but they're rejecting the label.
What I think is interesting is Lulit said, I identify as a feminist, but I also identify as a Black feminist. Lulit, as if that delineation had to be made. And what does that say about the feminist movement as a whole?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that historically, as our caller talked about, feminism has, in mainstream, has excluded women of color and Black women and Native women, right? So when we, women like me, take on that label, we demand that it's multidimensional. We ask that it's intersectional, meaning they examine all of the identities we hold. There's never a time I walk into a room and I'm just a woman, right? Which is what mainstream feminism asks of me. I am a Black woman. I am an immigrant woman. I am a woman who comes from rich, vibrant communities. So when we take feminism one step further, at its best, is intersectional. And I think that's what many women like myself and many women in my generation grasp onto in a different way than the traditional label of feminism.
Kathy, I wonder, you know, I've talked to Gloria Steinem about this, and she said, you know, she says that in the early days when she was out on college campuses, I think Florence Kennedy, I believe, if I've got the name right, an early activist, she was out there talking to college students, an African-American woman. Gloria Steinem would say, and some of the founders of the movement would say, this movement was never as narrow as this next generation of feminists want to make it. What turns up in your research to either support that or not?
Right. So let me say I also identify as a Black feminist. And while Gloria Steinem can have one version of history, the idea that there were Black women organizing is a truth. If we think about, for example, the Combahee River Collective, who has, you know, produced an incredible statement about kind of intersectional feminism. It doesn't mean that that group was embraced by mainstream feminists. So, in fact, I think you could have two parallel histories developing, and in fact, one that speaks to the lives in particular of women of color, one that, as Loli said, is intersectional, one that understands the kind of specific kind of struggles of poor women and poor women of color, one that understands that a feminist agenda can't only talk about issues of gender, but also has to talk about issues of race and class. So that's the first thing I would say. The second thing is, I think in our data, what we see is that young people believe that the feminist movement has largely benefited white women. So when we ask a question about how much do you think the feminist movement has done to improve the lives of white women, again, majorities of young people say it has done a lot or some. When we change that question and we ask how much has it done to improve the lives of women of color, then we see really almost less than a majority, you know, especially for African-Americans who say, well, it hasn't done that much for women of color. Then when we change the question one more time and ask what has the feminist movement done to improve the lives of poor women, it's a clear less than majority. Around 33%, 39% say it's done a lot or little or some to improve the lives. So there's a clear delineation for these young people between a feminist movement that benefits white women versus one that benefits women of color and one that is speaking to the lives of poor women.
I'm just going to emphasize that last part that you said again, because I thought this was really informative. White millennials of color are universal on how feminism has failed poor women. At least that's their perception. Is that yours, Luli, before we go back to the calls?
Absolutely. And I think that is the practice of using an intersectional analysis whenever we are approaching a problem. So if feminism asks the question of any given time, place, or circumstance, how are women uniquely impacted, taking it one step further and having a multi-issue, multi-problem analysis asks the question of at any given time, place, or circumstance, how are poor women, how are Black women, how are gay women, how are trans women uniquely impacted by a particular problem? And so feminism in its traditional sense did not always do that. And so women at the margins of our society had to do it for themselves. But what we see is that when we work from the margins, so when we are talking about addressing problems and finding solutions for women most impacted by either the wage gap or economics or health, it actually ends up benefiting all women, white, women of color, Native, all women.
Kathy, this is why the research you're doing, I think, is so valuable. Let's go back to the phones here. If you've just gotten in on the conversation, by the way, taking Kathy Cohen's work from the University of Chicago and her Gen Forward survey to talk about what she learned about how younger women are thinking about feminism, whether they're comfortable with the label of it, how they see feminism today, how they see the history of feminism. And Luli Mola with us, Vice President of Community Impact at the Women's Foundation of Minnesota, asking you this morning, if you're a young woman, a millennial, 18 to 35, let's just say, tell me what feminism means to you. And whether you identify with it, tell me about how you think feminism has either supported or failed women of our day, women who were there at the founding of feminism. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. On Twitter, Emily says, I'm 27. I believe strongly in the tenets of feminism. However, people I know who identify as feminists are so very extreme. Feminist friends of mine think men looking at them is raping with their eyes. Turns me off to the label. Kathy, I just have to come back to you on that. I think that's the result of a media distortion about what feminism is. I'd love to hear your take on that.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I think when you kind of consider the ways in which the media narrative around feminists has really kind of flattened the political agenda and discussion, right? Women, feminists become women who hate men. But I think there are also other ways that we want to think about how young people relate to feminism or relate to something else. So I think, again, there are lots of young women, often Black women, who would describe themselves as kind of adopting a womanist to think about an alternative framework for thinking about kind of the ways in which you embrace kind of thinking about the equality of women, but that takes an intersectional framework. There are also, for example, young people who identify as queer, who we would say would have a kind of radical analysis of gender, but who also might not identify as feminism in this sense, because in fact they think that feminism may not be radical enough when it comes to kind of thinking about gender identities and gender performances. So I think there are many reasons why young people might not identify with the framework of feminists. Some of it is a rejection of what they consider to be the kind of rigidness of what we might think of as a second wave feminist. Some of it might be that they don't think feminism is radical enough on issues of gender. And of course, as we've been talking about, some of it might be that, in fact, feminism as a label or as an ideology that they understand doesn't speak to the condition of the women that they identify with, the women in their communities, women of color. And then, of course, the last thing is, if you pay attention to the media, who would want to be a feminist, right? If, in fact, you think of feminism as women who are rigid, women who don't have fun, women who hate men, the complexity and the nuance of what it is to be a feminist is lost often in media caricatures.
Okay. To the phones here, to Tasha in Minneapolis. Hi, Tasha. Really glad you called. What are you thinking about?
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
I can. Yeah.
Okay, great. Yeah, I'm really appreciative of this conversation and the distinctions that we're drawing between mainstream Euro-American feminism, white feminism, right? And those of us, young women like myself, as a millennial, as a Dakota indigenous woman, as somebody who is biracial, who is very invested in the empowerment of women of color, but doesn't necessarily identify with this mainstream feminist movement. And I think, you know, one thing I want to push back on is even when we talk about the quote-unquote founding of feminism, mm-hmm. right, that's very specific to affluent white feminism.
Yeah.
If we talk about my people as indigenous people, we've been fighting colonial patriarchy since 1492, right, since colonization. And I think that one thing I wanted to add is that a lot of times when we create these intersectional movements, so much of that is about women of color educating white women and still catering to their needs. And that it's time now in 2018 for Black, Indigenous, women of color to be in leadership positions, to be advocating for the needs, wants, and dreams of our own people, and also to be able to have the space to lead without just having to educate and challenging white supremacy.
So Tasha, given what you've just said, do you feel like we're in a moment where biracial, women of color, all different women who want to be part of the movement are this newest movement, are being influential in changing it as we push it forward? And I guess I would also, I'd also ask you whether you think it's important to be part of this, of something that we think of as whatever this generation of the feminist movement is. What would you say to that?
Yeah, I think that we're living in a really exciting time. I mean, for me, I get so excited seeing so many different young women of color, indigenous women, black women, you know, being elevated in these leadership positions and having influence where, you know, it's time and we still have a really long ways to go. And I do think that there are movements that are more grassroots, more underground, that aren't elevated to the level of the mainstream. And so we do remain invisible
okay.
to a large part.
Okay.
And I think that's part of the issue as well.
Really interesting. I'm really glad you called. So the visibility piece of this, Luli, I mean, is that part of the advantage to saying there's a history to this? I can be part of this, I can change it? Or does what feminism brought to the table, the idea of it, you know, the history of it, is that not really important to what's happening today?
I think that we are continuing the foundational work that has been done thus far
okay.
on demanding equality and equity for women, for all women. At the Women's Foundation of Minnesota, we have an exciting initiative called the Young Women's Initiative, where young women of color, young women in rural Minnesota, young women with disabilities are not only the future leaders, but they're leading right now. So we're investing directly in their ideas. So they're doing everything from addressing the infant and maternal mortality rate in the Black community to creating a culture that is accepting in the science, technology, and math field to increasing representation in politics in rural Minnesota and for women of color. So young women, whether it be right here in Minnesota or nationally in the Me Too movement, gun violence, Black Lives Matter, are leading, right? And with social media, they're increasingly becoming visible. So it's not that the values of feminism is lost in any way or rejected. It's that it looks different, it goes further, is intersectional, is multi-issue, and frankly, it's more effective.
Rachel says on Twitter, your guests and callers made me realize that white women are late to the game. We've only been fighting for equality for 100 years or so. Women of color have been in this for thousands of years. My mind is blown. Lois says, I'm 68. As a teen, feminism seemed to be those who changed their minds from being traditional to those who were open to all avenues. But I already felt that way. Funny thing, I've had more traditional life than my mom did, but it worked for me. To Kathy in Plymouth. Hi, Kathy. How are you thinking about this?
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to talk about how when I was 18 and I learned about feminists and I read those articles from the original movement and how inspiring they were, and I started calling myself a feminist.
Uh-huh.
And how I would start getting so much negative feedback from people calling me a man-hating lesbian or like all these different things. Do you ever want someone to like you? And so I actually stopped talking about how I was a feminist for a really long time because I was sick of every time I said it, I knew someone was going to insult me or I'd have to figure out how to like defend my opinion.
So what did you do about that?
Well, it was like, you know, 5 years at least that I just stopped talking about it. And then I finally decided, you know what, this is worth talking about. And I'm
prepared to have those conversations, and they're important to have because I can change the opinion of those people that are going to say something negative to me.
Mm-hmm. So today, you call yourself a feminist.
Absolutely. Strong and proud.
Good to have the call. Grace called from South Dakota, and I wish we'd gotten to her. We've got really full phone lines here. She says, I'm not a millennial. I'm 15. A lot of people associate exclusivity with feminism. That's a problem. A lot of people think feminism is about excluding men. I don't think that. Kathy, I heard that satisfied chuckle when you heard that Grace was 15. What about what she says about the perception that there is something excluding about it?
Right. I was chuckling because I love that a 15-year-old was calling
in.
I
know.
Call her a Gen Zer. So I do love that. But I think to Grace's point, we have a responsibility in this show, of course, it takes us down that road, of reimagining what feminism and I think, as we would all say, kind of an intersectional feminism based in the lives of Black and Indigenous and women of color looks like, right? And it is a movement that can speak to multiple issues, not just, I would argue, equity for women, of course, but equity for all people, in particular women. It is a movement that's, for example, leading the Black Lives Matter movement or the movement for Black Lives that doesn't just speak to the condition of Black women, although that is central to the work of that movement, but speaks to the liberation of all Black people and a struggle against anti-Blackness, right? So I think if we understand a feminist ideology or a Black queer feminist ideology as about liberating all people, then I think we can kind of write a new narrative about what feminism is, how it's lived, what it's looked like, who's leading feminist organizations, and kind of turn the corner away from a very narrow understanding of feminism as being controlled and rooted in the lives of white women.
Do you think I don't want to say the founders of feminism, because now they're, as with Gloria Steinem, in their 80s, but do you think the people in what wave are we in, the third wave here? Of feminism, would you say, Kathy?
Well, I think some people would say we're in the fourth wave.
Fourth wave.
Right?
Okay.
Or, I mean, and some people reject the notion of waves, which often start
That's
with,
what
again,
I was going to ask you about.
Struggles of white women, right? People would say, if you look at the lives of Black and Indigenous and women of color, they've been fighting for the equality of themselves and their people since we got to these shores or since, you know, the land was taken from them. And so the idea of waves really is one that is rooted around the struggles, the organized struggles of often white women. So I think we're in a, you know, we're at a moment where in fact we can see the breadth of feminism and we can see the leadership of Black, queer, women of color feminists who have the kind of, I would argue, the broadest understanding of what a movement, not just an ideology, but a movement where people are actually on the ground and organizing around a feminist agenda, what it can do to improve the lives of all people.
Kathy Cohen with us if you've just gotten in on the show, and I hope you're going to stick with us. This is a really interesting conversation. She's a professor at the University of Chicago and founder of the Gen Forward survey that we're talking about. Asking millennials about a lot of different issues, but I really zeroed in on her research on what millennials are saying about the idea, the history, and the future of feminism. Luli Mola joined us in the conversation. She's Vice President of Community Impact at the Women's Foundation of Minnesota. They're doing a lot of great work on this right now. I want to hear from you. As a young woman, a millennial, tell me what feminism means to you. Tell me how you see this idea of these successive waves in feminism, where you fit into this, whether you're comfortable with the label or not. And overall, for all of us, I'd like to know what your perspective is on whether the feminist movements, again, these different waves, have improved life for women overall, especially in the moment that we're in right now, politically with the Me Too movement. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828 on Twitter at Carrie NPR, to Shaniqua in Worthington, Minnesota. Hey, Shaniqua, hi. Hey, thanks so much for waiting.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
What are you thinking about?
You know, I was just listening in, and I wanted to talk a little bit about rural Minnesota and how feminism can look out here. You know, I'm calling from Southwest Minnesota, and I think one thing that is often missed too when we're looking at feminism is the stigma behind the narrative of who can and who cannot be seen as aggressive.
Uh-huh.
As a Black woman and growing up in Southwest Minnesota, I'm trying to voice, if I'm working on representation, or if I'm trying to voice concern with how things are, with current structures are in place, or things that are currently working that I don't necessarily agree with, constantly having to be mindful of, am I being seen as an angry Black woman because I'm talking up or trying to address who is and who isn't in the room? When and where can I speak up and talk about feminism and talk about my place and why I feel that more women should be involved in anything from politics to just simple conversations at the dinner table? You'd never want to be seen in a space that doesn't look like me predominantly. You know, I'm in a space that's very diverse, but also around me and my neighbors, who are often, and the women of color are usually one of the few voices in the room. And so if we speak up, we want to make sure that we're articulate. We want to make sure that we don't hurt anybody's feelings. And I think that that's something when we're talking about how to speak up about feminism in different places, especially across the state of Minnesota, but holistically, you know, where does our voice work? When can we just not have to be politically correct about conversations surrounding feminism without being brought into, oh, this person's aggressive, they're emotional, they're tied in. And I think that's something that directly impacts the African-American community, but also the Black women community. When you speak up about feminism, when you try to act, and bring attention to the fact that, hey, maybe we need to do things a little bit differently. But also, you know, we have a stigma around some of our names. I'm Shaniqua. That's my first name. That's something that's really true to me and my identity, and a lot of us share that. If you see that on my resume, if you see that on me and the conversation, or you're bringing part of this leadership, you know, I'm 23 and trying to make a huge difference in my community. What does that look like, too, when you're carrying this idea of, you know what, if I say one thing that someone doesn't like, I'm the angry Black woman, I'm the aggressor, I'm not necessarily, you know, the most educated in the matter, or I'm too young to understand. These things that we're often told when it comes to voicing or showing disapprovement from a structure that's been in place.
So, Shaniqua, two things here. You have basically encapsulated what Rebecca Traister is talking about in her new book. And she's coming to Talking Volumes on October 17th. And I want to give you a couple tickets if you can make it up from Worthington. Do you think you can?
Yeah.
You have to be in the audience for this, Shaniqua, because this is exactly what we're going to talk about. So I'm going to put a couple tickets aside for you at the box office, all right? And I hope I meet you in the audience. The other thing is, I want to bring what you've just said to Lulit and Kathy about this idea of lacking leadership in among rural feminists and having an influence on the way the movement is developing. Lulit?
Yes. So we are a statewide foundation at the Women's Foundation. And so when we are looking to do our work to create a Minnesota where every woman and her family thrives and driving gender and racial equity, we ask these questions of how are, for example, Hmong women in the east side of St. Paul impacted by policies and solutions to problems in a different way than Black women in Worthington, Minnesota. And that is a prime example of having an intersectional approach to examining the way we live our lives.
That said, mm-hmm. I thought I heard Shaniqua was saying this feels kind of isolating out here and lonely out here. How do you make sure that the movement reaches, you know, beyond just the cities where there's a lot of energy around this?
So I think women like Shaniqua and other women in rural Minnesota have embodied the values of feminism from the beginning. They are existing and resisting every single day. They are running for seats. They are creating community change. They are running nonprofits and really saying we are here and we matter. I think that social media has increased connections amongst those of us that connect with the ideals of feminism, womanism, or just change agents in our state. And Shaniqua is a perfect example of our Young Women's Initiative. We are investing in women like Shaniqua to connect in her leadership, to connect with other women that are like her, so that they know what they believe in is valid, what they want for their communities and themselves is valid, and really, they are not alone.
Kathy, were you able to lay a geographical lens over the survey to see how people were reacting, given where they live?
Yeah. So part of the difficulty and the promise of a national survey is we have about 2,000 respondents. And that means that in any one area, there's no kind of clear sense of, I can't tell you exactly what people in Minnesota think. I could give you the numbers, but they wouldn't be sufficient for me to say, okay, this is what Minnesota thinks. I think one of the things we've tried to pay attention to is dividing the survey and disaggregating the survey by race and gender and ethnicity and class. And as you say, generally these trends hold across women of color and to some degree white women. They hold across poor women versus, for example, high-income women, right? The trends about not identifying as a feminist but agreeing with a more kind of a feminist political agenda. But the one other thing I would just say to Shaniqua, and yeah. I just really appreciated her call, was that I think she's also speaking to the difference between a feminist ideology or a feminist kind of policy agenda and a feminist movement. And that is the kind of deep connection that people feel, the ability to organize so that when folks say, oh, you're just an angry black woman, there are people there that have your back or that can validate you and say, yeah, you know, that always happens to me also. And that as we've been talking about, there are now kind of social media and digital tools that allow women who may not be concentrated in cities to connect to movements that are doing work both in cities and rural areas. And we have to just be cognizant of how do we kind of spread and build a movement around feminism that connects everyone who wants to be a part of this movement to the work that needs to be done.
Catherine called from Oakdale. She says, I'm 54. I consider myself a feminist. My daughter, who's 24 and is a lieutenant in the Army, I don't know if she considered herself a feminist. She takes a lot of things for granted, and she doesn't appreciate the history it took to get here. Bailey, who's saying previous waves of feminism had clear messages. Kathy, what would you say the messages of 2018?
Well, I'm going to push back a little, just like an academic, mm-hmm. right, and say I think there are some clear messages, right? I think we are, for example, in the Me Too movement moment. And so challenge to sexual harassment is part of the analysis and part of the messaging. I think the equality of women around pay, around access to things like contraception, the ability to have kind of subsidized and quality childcare. I think these are all part of what we might call a feminist movement. But I think the reason it maybe seems a bit more complicated at this moment mm-hmm. is if you take an intersectional approach, you are asking for a more nuanced understanding right. of things. So, for example, we could say that at this moment, we're also concerned about overturning Roe. So protecting and defending Roe is part of it. But I think an intersectional analysis would say that the kind of legal protections of Roe is just one level. What about women who don't have the financial security to really make choice, right, to decide, in fact, that they want to have an abortion and to proceed with that? And so I think at this moment, a more intersectional or black feminist or an indigenous feminist analysis says, of course, we're concerned about choice, but choice is about kind of legal security of choice, but it's also about the financial security and the political and social security of choice. And it just means a more elaborate and nuanced analysis, which doesn't always kind of mean that we have kind of easy sayings that people can link onto. Now, that is part of building a movement, but part of building a movement is also deepening one's analysis. And I think we're just going to ask people to go a bit deeper and think intersectionally.
Luli, listen to something that Jessica Valente, who also writes about feminism, said about the attention on women's empowerment on feminism and the messaging around that. There's been a watering down of the message in the sense that products are selling themselves using feminist rhetoric, and the anti-choice movement is glomming on to feminist rhetoric, and conservative women are calling themselves feminists while trying to strip women of their rights. There is a downside of coming to the middle or making things more sellable. You really do have to be careful. What do you hear in that?
Feminism can sometimes be trendy, right? The label. We saw it with multiple T-shirts that both men and women were wearing with feminist on it. I think it invites folks to the movement. When Beyoncé defined what feminism was in her song a couple of years ago, a lot of people, especially a lot of people outside of the academics or folks that know these words like intersectionality, etc., were invited and validated that they too can be feminist. In terms of what messages are there right now, I would say water is life, Black Lives Matter, no human being is illegal are multiple messages of today's feminism. And that really means it's more than having one clear message or one way to enter feminism, but really recognizing that women of color are threads in these multiple movements. So where we are trying to live full, just lives, and we come into it multiple paths. We have multiple messages because, again, we have multiple identities and live a multiple issue life.
I think you're both, I hear you both saying it's more dimensional, it's more nuanced, and that means that the brand can be a little more complicated. Kathy, is that fair to say?
Sure. And I think, I guess the brand of feminism can be appropriated for both, I would argue, progressive purposes, but also conservative purposes, as you were noting. Right. And again, this is going to go back to how do we get so let's take Beyoncé. Beyoncé engages us. She says, look, I'm a feminist. I'm going to flash it during my performance. But there has to be an infrastructure, right? There has to be organizing that takes people and takes young women who are now interested in feminism and says, actually, yes, this speaks to your life. It speaks to the conditions in your community, in your neighborhood, and this is how, and this is the work that we can do together, right? So it seems to me there's one thing about the brand. It's another thing about introducing people to feminism. But then, you know, to talk about the kind of organizing and infrastructure of feminism, which I would argue increasingly is being led by young women, women of color, trans women who present a different and more, I guess, inclusive understanding of what feminism can be in terms of the lives of people of color, of white women, of anyone who's kind of fighting for liberation and equality.
Emily says on Twitter, I'm having a parking lot moment listening to this nuanced and important conversation about the many intersecting movements for equality of all people with the feminist idea of equality for women. I just keep saying yes, yes, as your guests respond. And Jackie says, I've always liked this quote by Susan B. Anthony and repeated by Gloria Steinem as a call to the next generation. Our job is not to make young women grateful. It is to make them ungrateful so they keep going. Gratitude never radicalized anybody. Lulit, okay with that?
We don't have a chance to be ungrateful. If you are a woman of color living in this society, every single day you feel the oppression of systems that have been built so that you don't exist in your full life. So we understand what it means to fight for our dignity and our respect. So the young women we're working with in the Young Women's Initiative of Minnesota at the Women's Foundation, they're not walking around grateful for what feminism has built, although they recognize a lot of the privileges they hold. They are literally working to fight for their lives, whether they're undocumented or they're living in rural Minnesota or they're in the cities and don't have the access that they deserve to live this life we all say that everyone deserves. They are committed and passionate about creating opportunities that doesn't exist for them. So it's not about being grateful. It's about what kind of opportunities they are there for us. And then what do systems owe us? Right? Like, what do we need to do as a society, as systems, so that feminism isn't just the job of young women of color or even women? Feminism is the job of schools and companies and foundations and nonprofits and government to make sure that we are living the lives that we deserve.
I'm glad you brought that up. We have a call from Christine in St. Paul. Christine, you want to talk about your 14-year-old son and feminism, right?
Yeah, I was thinking that, you know, we really need to be including young boys in this conversation. We rarely hear the voices of men when talking about feminism, but especially not young boys. He had come to me about a year ago and said, Mom, you have to watch this video of this feminist. And I thought, uh-oh, I watched the video, and it was a video of a crazy, a woman acting very crazy as she had been pulled over by a policeman. And she wasn't shouting things about feminist issues. She was just an angry, angry person. And that's what his definition of a feminist person was. And so I had talked to him about, you know, I asked him a lot of questions about what he thought about, you know, feminist issues. And of course, it sounded like he agreed with everything that I thought. And I said, well, see, you're a feminist too. And he said, no, Mom, that is not what a feminist is. And so, you know, the message of 2018 is different to me than it is to my own son.
Right.
Because of all of the social media things that he is watching.
Kathy, here's an opportunity for a whole other show and a whole other hour, and I'm going to take it at some point. But I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Well, I mean, again, we want to differentiate how young women and how young men think about this, how gender nonconforming folks feel about these issues. What we've seen is that young women, at least in our data, are much more likely, again, to support kind of the policies of a feminist agenda. That young men, however, overwhelmingly support them, but just at a little lower rate. So, you know, we have to be engaging all people in thinking about issues of feminism and thinking about issues of equity and equality. And I will say also that there has to be thoughts of an intergenerational discussion. I think we've talked a lot today appropriately about young women.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I would say there is a kind of room for gratitude and to be grateful, but it's not that young women should be grateful to older women. It's instead that we should be grateful for people who are doing kind of political work and organizing that is meant to better the lives in significant ways and challenge institutions that would demean the people that we care and love about and recognize as human beings, right? So I think part of what feminism does is to tell us, yes, to look around and be grateful for the people who are doing that work and to join those people, to understand what is the ideology and the commitments that drive those people, to see it as something that, in fact, is a necessity if we care about human beings, right? So yes, we want to engage young boys. We want to engage young women. We want to have intergenerational discussions about this. And we have to understand this as political work that has to happen if we're committed to bettering humanity.
Agreed. I mean, I think what's happening there also, I fear, is that his perception of feminism, and this may apply to a lot of teenage boys, is intersecting with the idea of what real masculinity is, right? And we have, at the moment, some pretty dated, non-constructive, I'd say, images of what it really means to be a man. Lulit, do you want to say something about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So we did listening sessions. We engaged the voices of 800 young women as we built this initiative I mentioned. And every time young women said, there are no solutions with us or about us without including our brothers and the men in our lives. And intersectional feminism requires us to have whole family solutions. So we have funded programs like Journey Men at St. Paul Central, where groups of mostly Latino and African American men come together every week to talk about their own masculinity and what they vision the work to be to create safe spaces for women and girls. So men and boys are absolutely part of the solution, and we need them at the table advocating for the values of feminism. And maybe they don't call themselves feminists. It's okay. We did polling in Minnesota ourselves and found that generally, while Minnesotans don't resonate with the word feminism, they resonate with the values of feminism. And so as long as you're doing that work and you're coming to the table committed to creating access and opportunity for women and girls and essentially all people, then welcome. And please make your space feminist, join feminist movements, because at the end of the day, it's about feminism in action, not just in labels.
So Adam, when you tweeted, for all the men listening, can your guests offer advice on our roles and responsibilities in advancing these goals? I think you just heard a good call out there from Lulit on that. To Brooke in St. Paul. Hey, Brooke, thanks so much for waiting. Curious about what you're thinking about this. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I would definitely consider myself a feminist, but I think I always have been, just because I've always been a person who's empowered myself, my first sentence was me do it. I mean, I just, it comes to me like if I want to do something, my gender isn't going to hold me back. And something that I've come to realize is that when you're thinking about these things, you have to think about the end objective, and that would be equality, right? And so if you want to get to that equality, you have to keep in mind that it's a leveling of the playing field, and that means also celebrating femininity in men as well. And it's not just about women empowering women, it's about women empowering men, and it's about supporting people in their pursuit to be their most authentic self, whatever that is, regardless of social norms around gender or sexuality or anything else. So it's a much broader understanding of acceptance of us as multifaceted people.
Brooke, I'm curious, you're 21, right?
Yeah.
So what do your friends think when you're free to call yourself a feminist?
I would say I surround myself with people that have the same, values as me. And so I know I can speak for my best friend. She is definitely on the same page where, you know, if we're going to do something, we're going to do it. And we're not going to think about what it says about our gender, although we recognize it as being reflective of who we consider ourselves. And so I think that I live in the Twin Cities. I have pretty liberal friends who are all for empowering women for sure. But I think most of my friends have come, if you're assigning gender roles, I have more feminine male friends too. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's also a reflection of their acceptance of who they really are. You know, it's like, if you're going to call being emotional a feminine trait, I've found male friends who have found it okay for them to be emotional, and then they have inevitably found female friends who accept them as emotional functioning human beings, as they should be if they want to be.
Brooke, really good to have you on the show. Thanks for calling in. Kathy, before we close here, I really wanted to hear your thoughts on, you probably heard me talking about this forum that I have planned for September 27th,
yes,
where we're going to talk about being allied with one another across some of the barriers that I think have come up for this conversation. Will you tell me what you've learned about that in the year since the Me Too movement really broke out? And that was with the publication of that New York Times story about Weinstein.
Right. I mean, I guess I would push past the Me Too movement and say, you know, as someone who is not a millennial, much older than a millennial, been doing political work for a very long time, I think, the idea of being an ally means really thinking about kind of the structures that locate us differently. And what I mean by that is, if we go back to Brooke's call about, I loved it, being our most authentic selves, it is how do we kind of build a politic that really challenges the structures that oppress us and keep us from being our most authentic selves. It could be challenging kind of gender norms and embracing folks who are trans and gender nonconforming. It could be kind of challenging and really deconstructing hypermasculinity. It could be pushing back against kind of how we think about femininity. But it also means understanding kind of what happens in racial capitalism, right? So there's a lot of work for us to do to be real allies. It is not enough to say I'm a feminist and you're a feminist, so we're in struggle together. We need to have the same analysis and really deal with the things that make us uncomfortable and different at times.
Kathy, come back. More to talk about. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Lou Leet, thank you. And if you're free on September 27th, I'd love to have you in the audience.
Love to come. Thank you.
Thank you for everybody who called. The conversation continues.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Carrie at @KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.